all of you here in the live audience, plus those listening and watching us on Facebook at California District One Media on the Facebook page. This is an opportunity for you to get to know who these extraordinary people are who've stepped up and said, I'm in. I'm going to take the lead. By the way, I mentioned I am Elisa Parker. I'm the co-creator of Indivisible Women, which, by the way, is one of the larger Indivisible groups in the country. And we are pretty much comprised of local women here in Nevada County. Who's an Indivisible woman here? Do a shout out. Oh, they rallied today. They rallied. Okay, so I'm excited here to have with us Jessica Holcomb. She is a business attorney in Auburn, and she represents a number of small companies and tech startups. She received her MBA from UC Davis. Jessica is the oldest of seven kids, Jessica, who lived most of their childhood below the poverty line. She knew that her key to opportunity and success was higher education. She took an interest in politics in junior high, attending board of supervisor meetings and becoming school president. She received a scholarship and financial aid to attend Georgetown University and interned on Capitol Hill for Congresswoman Woolsey. After graduating from college, Jessica joined the U.S. Peace Corps in Russia. Everyone give it up for Jessica Holcomb. Also with us, we have Dennis Duncan. By the way, I've been privileged to meet all of the congressional candidates here on the hot seat here today. And I'm just so impressed with all of them. And I'm excited for you to meet them as well and hear some of their personal stories and motivation. So Dennis Duncan, he was born in the small town of Nevada, Missouri. Nevada. Is it Nevada, Dennis? Not like Nevada City. No. That's right. Okay. He grew up in Paradise, California, not far from here. In 1982, he graduated from the University of California, Berkeley with a degree in psychology. Because his family was low income, he received financial aid to get through school. Dennis has never forgotten that, and he decided that it was his responsibility to help others to try and repay the debt he feels he owes to society for the incredible education that he received. And so Dennis became a social worker, and during the course of his career, he has primarily worked with children, although he did spend about 10 years working with the homeless population in Chico. Since 2002, he has worked in the field of child welfare in Glenn and Butte counties. Let's give it up for Dennis Duncan. And last, but certainly not least, is Marty Walters. Also known as Martha, but we call her Marty. Marty has spent 30 years working in high-risk industries like hazardous waste management, military-based closures, and energy production facilities, ensuring that these operations are safe for people and the environment. Now as a risk officer for a large bank, Marty works with a wide range of small and large businesses to evaluate engineering, seismic, and environmental activities as part of providing loans to the energy, healthcare, real estate, high technology, and manufacturing sectors. Give it up for Marty Walters. Okay, so the first question that I think we're all dying to know, first of all, have any of you ever ran for office before? Just say yay or nay.
No.
Never, okay.
Never.
So what was the moment for each and every one of you when you decided, like, that's it, I'm stepping in, I'm going to take the lead, and I'm going to run for office, specifically this congressional district, California District 1 against the MALFA? And Marty, we'll start with you.
Oh, sure. Well, you know, I think all of us had quite an adventure last year during the election. And I had actually been spending a couple years before that working on economic issues in my own county. I come from Plumas County, and we've got some of the highest unemployment rates. We've got a huge opioid addiction problem. And we have a group of people that have been really excited and working on economic development issues in Plumas County. So I joined that group and was working on ways to figure out how to get into public service after spending all this time in banking and environmental work. So that moment came really as we were getting into the election, and my son told me, you've got to run for an office. So, you know, this was back in last February, March into June. And I started to think about it. And then, you know, when the election went the way it did, I said, yeah, it's time for me to throw my hat in and give it a try.
All right. Thank you, Marty. And I should also mention, you know, this district that we all live in, California District 1, it is the largest district, has the most counties in this district of California. Mm-hmm. Of course, we know that California represents more constituents than per representative than anywhere else in the United States. So we're certainly aware and mindful that there are other challenges that we face when we look at that. And of course, of that population, it really is 3% of California, but such a vital, important part. And it's been red for a couple of definitely at least two terms
since we redistricted.
Yeah. By the way, that's not happening again until 2020. So that's the big year. Jessica Holcomb, thanks so much for joining us. What was your moment when you said, "I'm stepping in. That's it. Enough's enough."
Well, yeah, like Marty said, I remember that moment when Trump got elected November 8th that evening, and I thought, no, this isn't happening. It was this moment of trauma as if it were in slow motion, like you were in a car wreck as you were watching the electoral votes come in. And that night, I remember waking up not once, but twice, but then five times, and I heard the helicopters going over my house. And I thought, oh no, something has drastically changed. But I thought at that point I would just become more of an activist. And so I joined an Indivisible group in Auburn that was started by a friend of ours. And as we got into talking about what we can do to flip the district blue, they said, we need to find more professional women to run for office. And hey, we nominate Jessica. And I was just sitting in the corner in my animal socks and taking some notes. I said, you guys want me to run? They said, yeah, we'd love to hear you speak. And I said, okay, I'll look into it. So as we've gotten into it, we said, we think this is doable. We think we can make this happen. So here I am.
Thank you so much, Jessica. And Dennis, how about for you?
Well, Lisa, for me, kind of like Jessica and Marty, it's November 8th was kind of a big day. For me, I kind of mulled it over, kind of going into January, and I continued to see how things were going in our country, and I became very concerned. As a father, as a grandfather, I worry about the future not only of our country, but about the future of my children and my grandchildren. And to be honest with you, as the days went on, I could no longer stand by and watch the way we were going. I did not feel like I had the option anymore. I had just seen what I thought. I'd seen Hillary Clinton with millions and millions of dollars and all of the advantages go down to defeat. And all of a sudden, it didn't seem like being standing by was an option. I could no longer do that. So I threw my hat in the ring. This has been a crazy ride.
And it's only been, Dennis,
and
what,
it's
like
only
six
been
months,
4 months, but I love every second of it. I get to travel around the most beautiful part of California that there is. I get to meet incredible people. I get to come and do things like this and meet more incredible people. I'm having a blast, and the only thing that will make it better is after I'm sworn in next year. Thank
That'll
you.
Be even better. Right. It is hard to believe, isn't it, that it's only been about 6 months since our last presidential election and since the three of you have stepped in to take the lead on this and run for office. What have been some of the key surprises? You know, and I think the primary questions I get from folks are, who's going to run against LaMalfa and how are they going to win? And we're going to talk about that in a little bit because we're going to get to some of the key questions. But I'm just curious, what surprises, as you've been putting skin in the game and you've been visiting this large district, California District 1, the rural north, as we're known, what have been one of the key surprises that you've discovered that maybe you hadn't thought of before? Because I'd like you each to mention, too, where you live as well. That'll give us some relevance to your insight on this.
Well, I'll go first and talk a little bit about, you know, I come from Plumas County. We're right in the middle of the whole district. And I find it so funny to come down here to Nevada City and Grass Valley and hear people say, we love what you say, but you're kind of conservative. And then I go up to Redding or to Mount Shasta and they say, we like what you say, but boy, you're kind of liberal. So we've got that, you know, we have definitely this big spectrum. And I think more than anything, when I speak to people, I'm really looking for that overlap. And I don't think it's necessarily a surprise, but it's very reaffirming to find there's a huge amount of overlap in terms of our personal interests and our personal situations from north to south, even though maybe the perception of that might be a little different.
Great, thanks. How about you, Jessica?
I think one thing that surprised me is all of my friends who voted for Trump are like, yeah, we want to volunteer for your campaign. We want to donate. And I think they just didn't realize the direction that the country was going to go in. I think they believed the sound bites that Trump made. I think they recognize now that LaMalfa has just been in lockstep with Trump and not thinking about the best interests of his district. And so when we talk about the policies versus voting on party lines, then we find that we actually are in agreement on a number of the key issues. So it's, you know, they voted for Trump more because they're conservatives, they're Republicans. He seemed like a cool guy. And now they realize the direction the country is going in, and they want to see some improvements.
And Jessica, you live in the Auburn.
Oh, that's right. Yeah. I live in Auburn.
And how about for you, Dennis?
Well, Alisa, I live in the Paradise area, Magalia, to be exact. And to kind of piggyback on what Jessica was saying, one of the things that I've discovered is that on Facebook, I get a lot of folks from the right responding to my page. I don't know how they're finding me, but they are. And I have to thank my wife, who's a psychotherapist, for helping me out with this, because oftentimes they're very angry at me. And my first response is, well, who the heck do you think you are? But she said, you know what, Dennis? Don't respond to the words. Respond to the emotion. Their emotions are very similar to those of what we feel. Mm-hmm. They feel abandoned.
Mm-hmm.
They feel like their dreams have been left behind. They don't have any. I had one lady send me a horrible message telling me what a commie I was. And then I chatted with her a little more. She's got four generations living under one roof. Her family needs help. I offered her some of the policies, and she said she wouldn't think about it. I haven't heard from her since. She may have written me up or not. I don't know. This is going to be an interesting experiment as we move forward. We need to peel about 10% of Mr. LaMalfa's voters away. About 1 out of 10. I think it's possible. This district needs help. He's not giving it to us. Mm-hmm. And that's what any of us can do. And that's where we're heading.
Thank you, Dennis. What do you think? Do you think it's possible?
Yeah.
Yes. I should say we're nonpartisan here in this room, but yes. I've learned from this last election, I speak of this often, that anything is possible. By the way, that's one thing we've learned, that anything is possible. So a good transition into that is we talk about the economic conditions that many of us are all facing here, especially being in a rural community. You know, we talk about the new rural economy. So what do you think are the key features to a new rural economy, and what's required for our district to get there? And we'll start with you, Jessica.
Well, the prerequisite for improving the job situation in our economy and attracting more working families and keeping a lot of our college graduates here in the area is going to be broadband. There is no reason anyone who works remotely or who is a coder who wants to start a business would move to a remote area where they don't have reliable and fast broadband connections. So that's definitely a prerequisite. But on top of that, we need to do more to provide funding for our innovation labs. We've got an Innovate North State in Chico. We've got Shasta Ventures in Reading, providing funding for a lot of our entrepreneurs here in the area, and also block grants so that if they are prepared to open their doors for business here in the district and to hire employees and to keep a tech hub here, then we'll see a lot of the innovation that we've seen in Sacramento and in Davis, and of course, which sprouted originally in the Silicon Valley. We'll be able to bring some of that prosperity to this district. And I think that's really going to be key, and that's our competitive advantage for lowering the unemployment rate and increasing the population of young working people and professional college graduates. Another key point is going to be opening rural clinics and making sure that we have the health care needs for rural areas. So there's got to be more federal funding for that. And the way to attract healthcare professionals is by student loan forgiveness and also a sense of inclusiveness. I was reading about a Muslim doctor who had moved to Ohio to help a small community, but with a lot of the anti-Muslim rhetoric coming from the Trump administration and a lot of people who had voted in his district for Trump, he became wary and he thought about relocating. So if we want to attract talent from urban areas, we've got to have a sense of tolerance and inclusion. And affordable housing is going to be key as well. If we provide more funding for first-time homeowners to make a down payment and to get affordable loans, that will also encourage a lot of our college grads to stay here, make their homes here, open their businesses here, and bring more prosperity to our region.
Thanks, Jessica. Marty, how about for you? New rural economy.
You know, I think for us to be successful, we have to think about the fact that our communities are sprinkled all across these mountains. We have to get those rural economic engines turning in all of our rural communities at once. And that's a really tricky thing for us to do. And I think it's going to take really supporting jobs that are both creative as well as service-oriented jobs. You know, creative jobs make a community a place that we want to live and that we want to come and visit. The service jobs are really important for our older people to stay in their homes and live independently. We've got a project going on right now in Plumas County to develop a property management co-op. So a group of people who want to get together and do property management services. And it's not only going to help us improve the housing stock that you mentioned, you know, getting better quality housing and more affordable housing, but it's also going to help our seniors stay in their homes longer. We don't have assisted living facilities. It's really key for our population to be independent as long as possible and get the kind of help that they need in a context that's going to also help our younger people get work. And it's not all going to be college-educated programmers. We need work for farmers, and we need work for people who are going to, you know, repair and take care of our homes, and we need work for artists and musicians and everybody else that lives in these small rural communities.
Thanks, Marty. Dennis.
Well, Alisa, as anybody who's been following my campaign knows, I've proposed $750 billion through a law that I would pass called the Renew America Act. One-third of this act, of the money allotted, would be for broadband internet nationwide. The remainder would be for renewable energy, again, nationwide. I think that the next 25 years is going to be closely tied to renewable energy as far as our economy in this area and throughout a lot of rural America. However, and by the way, this will be about, I estimate, 300 jobs here in District 1 alone. But that's not really enough. We need to do more. Two of the things that we have been missing in this area in order to bring this economy up are, number one, leadership and capital. We've been missing leadership for decades. We hear our current representative talking again and again and again about what he's going to do for our economy. I cannot think of anything that has been done. What I would propose as the representative for this area is bringing together business, community, political leaders in each and every area, town that is economically afflicted, sitting them down and hearing what their strengths are. You have to build on your strengths when it comes to building an economy. You have to minimize your weaknesses. We have to figure out what the strengths are in each community because, quite frankly, when it comes to an area this big and this rural, you have to throw out the cookie cutter. When I was in school, we studied urban development and rural development. Urban development, you can use more of a cookie cutter because you have a lot of people all jammed in together. Here, every community has different demographics. They have different politics, they have different resources to take from. Reading is on I-5. Quincy has difficulties with that because it's more removed. So every community is different. It would require, again, leadership and capital. when you have the former, you can get the latter. And that is what I would bring to this district.
Thank you, Dennis. By the way, we are broadcasting live here at KVMR. You can also find us at California District 1 Media on the Facebook page. We're going to be here until 5 o'clock p.m. We have an opportunity here to hear from the U.S. California District 1 congressional candidates, Marty Walters and Jessica Holcomb. And Dennis Duncan are here with us today. Of course, we mentioned we invited LaMalfa, and he declined. So a good segue to that, talking about, I guess, going across the line. Where's Robert, by the way? Robert, hey, Robert, come on up here for a sec. And so, Robert, do you want to let us know what your question was around politics and how do we cross that line? Because I do keep hearing that, yes, there is that division, right? Yes, when we get to the healthcare discussion, that 31% of the folks in our community are utilizing, right, Medicare or Obamacare, compared to in urban areas that might be like 16%. But we seem to have some similar concerns across the line, though, when it comes to education, healthcare. What was your question, though, about how are we going to get things done, as you mentioned, Dennis, in such a large region?
Yeah, my question was, politics has become very adversarial as of late, especially, and I'm wondering how you personally will be able to work across the line, across the divisions between the parties, and be able to get things accomplished as opposed to the deadlock that we're seeing right now.
Great. Thanks, Robert. Marty, let's start with you.
Oh, gosh, yeah. That, you know, working across the line, the problem is that we all think there's a line. And in fact, you know, there really isn't a line. We've got a lot of people here who have been treated very badly by the federal government and by big companies who have just abandoned us. And we need to do something that's going to bring back jobs and bring back some of that prosperity. You know, logging has completely gone from this region. We've got a few small companies that are still operating logging mills and barely any jobs at all. And that's, you know, that is universal. That applies to everyone, whether you're considered a Democrat or whether you're considered a Republican. That kind of discussion is what we need to have with all of our voters. You know, some people say, well, what are you going to do to make sure that we make this a Democratic district? Quite frankly, I don't care if we're a Democratic district. I want us to be represented. I want us to really be represented more than I care about being a Democratic district. And that's going to mean that we've got to have somebody in Congress who understands who we are, who our region is, and exactly what the economy is going to be based on. We can't bring back these old industries like logging and mining. We've got to go to these new areas. And I think that's the real focus of the conversation we have to have with our neighbors and our friends and our, in my case, my stepdad and a bunch of my sisters and brothers.
Right. How many here have family members who voted for Trump, by the way? Right. Okay. How about you, Jessica?
Yeah, I completely agree with Marty. I think it's a matter of reaching across party lines to discuss the policies that really matter to the people here in our district. And LaMalfa is caught up in economic nostalgia. He talks about how the regulatory agencies have really held us back, and he's lost in these dreams of what this district used to be, and its strength in timber and in mining. Those are bygone days. Our real competitive advantage now is in technology. It's also in tourism. We've got a lot of people with the growth of the population in the Bay Area and in Sacramento who love to come up here and recreate and visit in the summer. So we've got to not only maintain our national monuments and provide funding for our national parks for the long-term viability of these beautiful natural treasures, but also because they're a key source of income for our district. So I think it's emphasizing that, those things that we really value, and also the healthcare issue. You know, we are the true patriots of our country when we want to ensure that everybody has healthcare insurance. That is patriotic. Claiming that healthcare is not a right, that it's something that, you know, your employer should provide to you or that you should pay for yourself. How can you truly call yourself a patriot if that's your stance?
Thanks, Jessica. And Dennis?
You know, Alisa, I try to spend a lot of time crossing the line, because to win, we have to do that. There are more Republicans than there are Democrats, and that's just the way it is. That, and I feel that I have a good chance to reach across that line because I do not believe that this election is about Republicans versus Democrats. It's about Republicans versus families. Mr. LaMalfa and his party have been attacking the families of this country for decades. They have attacked the middle class repeatedly for decades. That is why one of the main reasons I am in this. When I say families first, this is not some maudlin thing. We need to defend American families from these policies, which do not allow parents to make enough money to send their kids to school. Kids who want to go to school have to take out tens of thousands of dollars in student loans. These policies are an attack on our families. I'm going to keep bringing this up throughout this campaign, and I think it's going to ring true with folks throughout this district, because people in this district love their families. People in this district oftentimes have difficulties with poverty or they're lower middle class, and family may be the only thing they have. I'm going to appeal to that, not because it's the political thing to do, because it's the right thing to do.
By the way, people can express their own feelings. That too, by the way. It's not the library, people. We're breaking new ground, right? Haven't we learned that sometimes you got to break the rules a little bit? Marty, did you want to say something to
that? You know, I was listening to Dennis, and I really think that we also have a pretty strong libertarian streak in this corner of California that you can't ignore. And you know, that we there is a balance there, and I think we have to really acknowledge that trying to do something like send every kid to college and pay for that is perhaps going to be a cost that not everyone wants to bear. There's, you know, there's a personal responsibility and libertarian side of all of us, and we have to balance that against what we're going to do to actually, you know, create policies that create sustainable types of engines that keep going on their own. And I think it's really important to think about how do we pay for things? How do we get everyone involved in making those decisions for themselves and keep that sense of independence in our district? Because it's a lot of what defines us, and it's a lot of what brings people to the mountains. And it's, you know, that self-reliance has been a really key characteristic of ours for generations here, you know, going back to the gold mining days. So I do think that there's so much room for doing that kind of program in Washington, but we got to figure out ways to pay for things. And we also have to make it a choice that people make for themselves. And that's a really key aspect of any of our programs, whether it's healthcare or education. We need them to feel that value and to make that decision for themselves and not make it a presumption.
Well, and Jessica, I know education has...
Yes, Robert.
Education is a passion of yours, as I know Marty and Dennis, yours as well. It was interesting. I heard there was a study recently that, you know, it used to be that having a college education was highly aspired by both on Democrats and Republican sides. And there was recently a survey that of the Republicans polled, over, I think it was like 50% said that they viewed higher education as a form of elitism. So we both have that, both being in a rural community where we may not get access to internet, for example. So we're already losing on that end, especially when we look at our youth. And then, of course, the debt that is incurred. Anyone else have college debt? Right here, right? Over half the room. So Jessica, how would you like to reply to that? And then I know Sheila had a question as well that ties into education in our schools here in our community.
Yes. So actually, the United States is one of the few Western countries where education, higher education for universities or for vocational training, is astronomically expensive. If you decide to go to law school now or to med school, you can be looking at graduating with debt in excess of $200,000. So this debt is really crippling for a lot of recent grads, and there's no reason for it. The reason that our public school education at the university level is not free is really a matter of budget priorities. We spend more than the next seven countries combined on our military, and now we're going to be spending more. there's no reason that we need to spend that much on our military. We can allocate some of those resources to ensuring that a public level university level education is available to all of our citizens. So New York is doing it. You know, we can certainly do it here in California. And we won't have our graduates coming out of school with this crippling debt. And we also won't have families refinancing their homes or passing the hat around among relatives to dip well into their savings to make sure that their kids can go to college. We even have situations where grandparents are paying to take out student loans for their grandchildren. They can't repay the loans, and then their Social Security checks are being docked. So it's become a situation where now our next generation of college grads really can't get ahead financially because of the student loan situation. So if New York can do it, we can certainly do it as a nation.
Dennis and Marty, I want a chance for you to speak to that as well. Sheila, what was your question around... here, come on over here. It's live radio, Sheila Cameron.
So a lot of people in this area, and I think in the district, really enjoy charter schools and school choice. I don't think that people in the federal government now really represent the type of attitude we want to have around charter schools. And I'm wondering if you have any thoughts on how we can both maintain school choice for different kinds of learners and support public education and really sort of buttress that, you know, kind of come to the middle on that issue instead of making it an all or one.
What do you think, Marty?
You know, I was just thinking as you're talking about that I have three kids and none of them went the traditional path through school. We were living in Tokyo for a little while and they got to go to this really fancy private school. And then we were living in Quincy, and a couple of them went to the local public high school for a couple of years. And then one of them just couldn't handle that and went to the charter school, and it was a really good match. And then also using the local community college to help, you know, with classes while they were still in high school. My middle kid just graduated from Berkeley a year early in neuroscience because she spent that time at the local community college gathering up credits and preparing herself to go to Berkeley. And that was a huge benefit to her, but it was not the classic path through school. And everyone has that, you know, everyone's got that kid in their life that doesn't fit into the normal school. And we have to, you know, we have to respond to that. I think kids who are, you know, who do well in public school, I was one of those. I did great in public school and I was able to get myself into all those, you know, the pegs were in the holes with no problem. But not everyone's that way. And I, as a parent, I've really had to adjust to that. And, you know, we need to support those different options. One of the things I really wish is that my school district, for example, would support the alternative charter schools through the facility side of things. You know, we're in this rural district that has not as many kids, and we have this burden of all these facilities. And at the same time, we don't want to close the schools because, you know, the loss of a high school and a high school campus in a community can just be tremendously traumatic for people. And yet our local school district won't allow the charter school to use those facilities, you know, for whatever reason it is that they can't get along. And I think that's where, you know, the federal government can really come in terms of setting standards and really supporting different public options. And I think that's the key, is to keep it public and support different paths that people can take to get through that primary education and get set up for success, whether it's going to college or whether it's doing something else.
Thanks, Marty. It's true. They need to come to Nevada County, where we've actually practiced that model. As some of our younger population has decreased here, at least in the public school attendance, and we've started consolidating, it's interesting because then charter schools are taking on those spaces. It starts often as parent directed learning, you know, for parents expressing, and because there is no kids learn in all different kinds of ways. And it was interesting. We had the lieutenant governor candidate here last week, Elaney, and she was really surprised to hear how influential and how prominent our charter schools were here just in Nevada County, that they weren't necessarily religious based here. And that kind of blew her away. It gave her just a different way of thinking about how we're optimizing and leveraging education through charter schools. Dennis, how about for you?
This is an interesting question. This two or three months ago, I was at a meeting of the Paradise Ridge Democrats. I graduated from Paradise High, the Bobcats, and it was brought up at that meeting that there's going to be, like within the next year, a charter school for high school kids in Paradise. And this was a huge thing. Paradise is a small town. Paradise High, the football games at Paradise High, people, they're in Paradise, every person on game day has a t-shirt on that says, "We just hit people." Because the Paradise High Bobcats are close to a religious thing. It is a big deal in Paradise. I played football in Paradise, and I know it is a big deal. When this was found out, people were up in arms. And to be honest with you, I was too. But I had to stop and think about it. What's best for the kids? Maybe we need another school that would serve the kids better. Maybe it might be that the Bobcats football team might not be as good next year, but we'll have kids who are getting better services. And that's where I stand on that.
Thank you, Dennis. Healthcare. Boy, that's the hot question, I think, right? First of all, I'm just curious. We asked this question at a recent... Well, Jessica, did you want to add anything else about that? I'm also aware, too, because you prompted... Well, Jessica prompted the education discussion. Yes. But is there anything else you wanted to add to that?
Well, I think I agree with Marty. You know, whether it's a traditional public school or a charter school, we definitely need to provide more federal funding for our schools. We rank actually below Vietnam in both science and math. And so we really rank much lower than all of the other Western and developed countries when it comes to key studies that will keep us competitive in the global economy. And you see quite a disparity depending on what part of the country you're in and the caliber of schools that parents can send their children to. So if you go to Palo Alto and to one of the local public schools, you'll be astounded by the level of education and the access to all of the opportunities that the students have there. Whereas if you go to a school in Mississippi that's not receiving very much tax revenue from property taxes in order to fund those local schools, you'll find empty classrooms with no books and no materials. Even in this area, I've heard from teachers that they have to buy pencils and markers for their kids. Yeah. So if we want to remain competitive in the global economy, if we want to see our nation succeed, we have to invest in our grammar schools, in our high schools, and make sure that we provide our kids with the skills they need to get the jobs that they'll go on to pursue either in vocational training or at the university level.
Yeah. Thanks, Jessica. And I should mention, too, and clarify, the charter schools we've been referring to here are all public charter schools. Unlike some charter schools, maybe if we were in San Francisco, where you're paying high dollars for your child to attend, these are all public schools. Dennis, you wanted to add one thing about that.
Well, before we talked about the charter schools, we were talking about university education and such, and I just wanted to kind of reiterate what Jessica and Marty were saying, that we do have a huge amount of student debt in our country. There's currently 44 million people with student loans. Most of those folks are between 25 and 40. Average loan is about $25,000. That comes out to a little over $1 trillion in student loans right now in the United States. The sad part about this is we have a lot of people. A lot of them are kind of middle class folks. They've got a college degree. But they're having to pay between $300 and $500 a month in student loans. They can't do simple things like make a down payment on a house, buy a car. I met a lady in Grass Valley a few months ago, and she came up to talk to me afterward. She would like to get married, but she can't. She's got too many student loans. She can't afford it. The student loan situation in our country right now is one of the issues that is not really on the political radar, but I believe it is another issue that is truly dragging our middle class down. I proposed a law. It's a very expensive law, Marty. But hang in there. It would pay off up to 90% of each individual student loan in the United States. Yes, it would cost almost $1 trillion, but we could pay it off. We could pay that debt off in 5 years doing the transactional tax that Senator Sanders has talked about, and which I have come out in favor of, which is, I believe, 0.01% per trade. This could be paid off. This could be paid off in 5 years. We loosen up our middle class, allow them to do the things that a middle class should be able to do. And that's what I had to say about
that. Thanks, Dennis. Marty, I'm like, oh, we could talk about all these issues for a long time.
You could. I would love to move on to healthcare. I think we've talked enough about education at the moment.
Let's go on. Well, and healthy kids, right?
Yes,
healthy kids,
absolutely.
Also healthy schools. And going to the healthcare question, I asked this question at our last Indivisible Women Gather Up around how many folks know of someone or have been affected because they didn't get the healthcare that they needed. Like, stand up if you have. If you know of someone that didn't get the health care they needed because...
I'm going to stand up, too.
I'm standing up, too. How many here are recipients, perhaps, of Obamacare or Medicaid? All right.
Yeah, I think a lot of us are.
Over 31% of us are. So, Lee, you had a question around health care. I know it was two parts. Want to start with the first part, and then we can get into single payer?
Sure.
Unless you remember when it is. Okay, I'm
going to
hold this.
So now that the GOP health care bill has failed, it looks like there may be a real opportunity to move on single payer at the national level.
Woo! Woo!
What is your opinion of single payer, and what would you do, if anything, to make this happen?
Thank you, Lee. By the way, Lee is one of the founders. Is it Indivisible Gold Country? All right, let's give it up for Indivisible Gold Country, too. We have over 5 Indivisible groups just here in Nevada County, and we are broadcasting live here at KVMR. I'm speaking with Marty Walters and Jessica Holcomb and Dennis Duncan, who are congressional candidates for District 1, upseating LaMalfa. Okay, so healthcare. Who wants to? Jessica, do you want to jump in with that?
Sure, absolutely. So, yeah, it's high time that we have universal healthcare in the United States. We are the only Western country without it. And the reason for that is because of the power of the insurance companies and the pharmaceutical companies, the many millions and billions of dollars that they've spent on lobbying and donations to politicians to make sure that they get their piece of the healthcare pie. And really, the insurance companies are not providing any other added value to our healthcare other than just administrating the bills. And we could save significantly, maybe 20 to 30% on the actual healthcare costs that we're paying just by getting this middleman out of the equation and allowing our governments to administer it the way they do for Medicare. The administrative costs are only about 6% because we're not worried about the profit margins the way the insurance companies are. The question that comes up a lot with universal health care is, how do we pay for it? It's going to be too expensive. That's what the critics say. Actually, the opposite is true. We will be saving, based on the analysis in California, we'd save $30 to $40 billion alone. So it's just a matter of identifying where the funds are going to come from. And what I propose is those employers and those individuals that are already paying something for health care versus the form of a tax, you allocate those funds to a general funding pool as part of single payer. You'll be paying a reduced cost because now you've got a single payer negotiating the cost of health care and negotiating the rates that we're going to be paying for prescription drugs. And you pay that into a fund to finance universal health care. And then we don't have to worry about what may or may not be considered an essential health benefit from the insurance company, We don't need to worry about caps on our insurance. We don't need to worry about whether or not we have a pre-existing condition or how old we are. We know that we'll be insured no matter what. The system works perfectly well, even with private doctors and private hospitals in a lot of Western countries. There's no reason we can't do it too. So let's make it happen.
Yeah. Thank you, Jessica. Marty Walters.
Well, the healthcare system, you know, who knew it could be so complicated? Listening to all that, it's complicated. But, you know, in fact, it's a really good question. And, you know, we know that the GOP plan is not happening as of this moment. But what we really need is that roadmap for how we're going to get to single payer, because it is very complicated. And we need that roadmap. I really think that we need to bring together all of these federal dollars that we're spending on healthcare right now. It's whether it's Medicare or Medicaid, you know, the Veterans Administration programs, and bring it under one umbrella so that we have something like the Department of Homeland Security where we can really leverage those dollars. We have a pretty good system in Medicare that a lot of people point to as being maybe the end point of that map, right? Where we're going to get to at the end. I don't know if that's where we're going to end up, but it sounds like a reasonable plan. And I want to put a roadmap in place. And I think maybe the first step is to really consolidate the power of the federal government and the money that we're already spending into one single agency that can really leverage those costs and figure out the standards that we're going to meet. And then gradually bring in those people like me who are on private insurance, but who are already benefiting from things like the essential benefits packages and all those things that we already have, and bring it in so that the cost is now coming from a single source. Insurance cost. And so I think that roadmap is the first step, and bringing together all of our federal dollars to really make it work for us is the second step.
Great. Thank you, Marty. I know we've been wondering, where is that roadmap? That's the last
roadmap.
GOP has been so focused on, you would think, the last over 8 years or so.
Absolutely.
Takes a while to make a map, I guess, in some case. Okay. Dennis.
I am a huge supporter of H.R. 676, the Extended and Improved Medicare for All Act. When I go to Congress, I look forward to becoming a co-sponsor after I'm sworn in. I look forward to voting for it. I believe that after we get in the House a majority, that this is the law that we have to aggressively bring forward and put it on President Trump's desk. Assuming President Trump is still there. We will place it on his desk. And we will say, do it or not. You promised the American people that you were going to have a health care plan that covered everybody. You said it was going to be beautiful. This is awful.
And so great.
Awful good. This is very good looking and so great. This is very good looking. I want to put him on the spot as to whether or not he will sign it. I have a feeling he won't. But nevertheless, currently, we still have the ACA in place. I personally do not believe that the GOP has the political will to get rid of it. They do. They have a very unpopular president. They've just taken a beating. I think they're whipped. And we're going to see the ACA continue on until we can get Medicare for all. This is going to truly be President Obama's legacy. The ACA is going to lead to Medicare for all. We have a GOP now that 5 years ago, 10 years ago, would have never considered discussing health care as a national issue. Now, they are not only discussing it as a national issue, but they suddenly feel a huge rush to get something done, even if it is just an awful bill.
That's right.
Yes.
I'm sorry, for those who've never heard of that bill, can you give a brief summary of it?
Brief summary of the bill for those who've never heard of it.
A brief summary of it. House Resolution 676 was written by Representative John Conyers of Michigan. Good golly, the last time I looked, it had well over 100 co-sponsors in the House. Virtually every Democrat had co-sponsored it. And it is also sitting, oddly enough, in the Subcommittee on Indian and Consular Affairs, which one Doug LaMalfa is the member of. And I would urge each and every one of you to give your representative a call and tell him you would like to see H.R. 676 come out of that subcommittee and be debated on the House floor.
Okay, thank you, good. Dennis. Robert, you had another question regarding marijuana as we segue from healthcare to actually marijuana, which is very much ties into that here in Nevada County.
It related.
I was just wondering if you support the full and complete decriminalization of marijuana, given the fact that we've got a failed war on drugs right now.
Mm-hmm. All right, let's start with Marty.
Well, you know, it's interesting. Just last weekend, I spent a day in Reading at a cannabis cultivating fair. I didn't know a whole lot about it before that, but I went into that just wanting to learn. And it was really interesting to talk to all the people who were involved in the different aspects of growing cannabis and what does it mean. And then the other thing that has happened that's happening right now in California is that we've got this licensing program that's being developed. And right now there's a public comment period for that licensing program's environmental impact. And so that's another thing that you all can get involved with in terms of getting that, your views on cannabis into the public sphere here in California now that we've decriminalized it at the recreational level. But at the federal level, we need to get it off that list of controlled substance Schedule 1. It's the most critical thing that we need to do to eliminate the barriers that we have for people to use it in the way that we've decided to use it here in California.
Thanks, Marty. Dennis. And I'm going to ask we keep these two, if you could do it to 1 minute or less, which you're doing a great job right now, but I'm mindful we have about 5 minutes, and I want to make sure we get to just a couple other things as well.
I'll keep it brief, Elisa. Yes. Yes. I see decriminalization from my standpoint as someone who works closely with law enforcement. This is a public safety issue. Mm-hmm. I used to work in Glenn County, and in the Mendocino Mountain Range, it was filled with illegal pot grows by folks who had come up here from Mexico with the cartels. People from Willows and Orland love to go up there, hunt wild boar, deer, whatever. They could not, because there was a real danger that they would be shot or there would be some sort of bear trap. So for me, yes, I completely support decriminalization.
Thanks, Dennis. And Jessica, decriminalizing marijuana.
Yeah, absolutely. So I was watching a clip of LaMalfa recently. This was just a couple of days ago. And he was talking about illegal marijuana farms and how they're owned by the Mexican drug cartels. And I was thinking, how can he be so out of touch with his own district? Here in Nevada County, we have a lot of cottage growers who are, you know, growing marijuana for the medical marijuana centers. And soon we're going to see, you know, the full legalization of marijuana in the state and hopefully at the federal level, because we really should begin treating marijuana businesses and the growers like the legitimate businesses that they are, so that they can get loans from banks, they can open bank accounts, and they can operate on not just strictly a cash basis. And the governor of Nevada has recognized this, even though he was opposed to legalizing recreational marijuana in the state of Nevada. Once the legislature passed it, he said, great, how fast can we actually get this on the market and get the tax revenue in? So it's high time we legalize both medicinal marijuana at the federal level, but also recreational marijuana.
She said high time.
It's high time.
As we wrap this up, I know the big question that comes up constantly is, okay, we have some extraordinary candidates here. How are we going to unseat LaMalfa? Robin, did you want to add to that at all? I know you had something specific around that.
Yeah. Hi, my name's Robin Black. So I would love for each of you to say specifically what you would like to do to unseat LaMalfa. I hear people all the time saying we need to get rid of him, and candidates saying I'm going to be the person to do it, but how? I would love to know how.
We know that we need like 40,000 votes on the Democratic side, at least. And so, yeah, this is your marathon time to make this happen, but it's the big question we all have is how are we going to do that, and how does your personal experience and skill set tie into that? Let's start with Marty. Let's start with you.
Oh, gosh. So, you know, the way we're going to do it is by making the Democratic Party actually perform to our numbers. We have underperformed in all of these last elections. Yeah. If you're registered as a Democrat, you got to come out and vote. We have great things happening on the voter registration side with our motor voter law. It's going to be an automatic thing. And over the next 5 years, as you renew your license, you're going to automatically be registered. So that's going to be really good in terms of representation. And then I think the last thing is we've got to be super smart about the numbers and be not just good about messaging, because I think what we're doing here is really important about getting the issues out there and talking about issues, but we have to be equally smart about how we approach our voters and get them to come out to the polls and vote. Ultimately, that's what we want. We want representation, and we want representation that reflects our values and our people here and not a particular point of view that the Republicans have.
Great. Thank you, Marty Walters. Thank you, Jessica Holcomb.
So it's going to take an army. We're not going to just need a volunteer group of 20 or 30 people. It's going to take hundreds of people, and it will require a lot of resources. So that's why I've actually been reaching out to contacts in the Bay Area that helped with other congressional campaigns to provide us with the resources we need here so we can hire staff, mobilize volunteers, and get out the voting effort. So we're going to be knocking on every door. We're going to be calling those lists of thousands of voters and making sure they get out and they know the importance of this election. So if you haven't signed up yet to volunteer in a campaign, be sure and do that. Come contact one of us before we leave, and let's get out the vote.
Yeah. Dennis, 30 seconds.
Okay.
Magic man, make
it
happen.
Here we go. Real basic. When I get out there, the main message I want to get out is I'm an old-time Democrat, FDR Truman. I care about families. I care about kids. I care about parents. I care about the middle class and the poor. These are what Democrats, this is what we do. This is what I do. If you want somebody in Washington who's going to help your family, who's going to help them rise from being poor, who's going to help them as a middle class person get your kids into college, I'm your man.
You've been listening to the Democratic candidates for the first congressional district in California, currently held by Doug LaMalfa. And the roundtable was with Jessica Holcomb, Marty Walters, and Dennis Duncan, and was hosted by Alyssa Parker. Thank you all very much for listening. And coming up next on KZFR, it's Les Show. 90.1 KZFR Chico. 90.1 KZFR presents an evening of comedy and political craziness with Will Durst and Mary Standish at the Chico Women's Club.
Everybody says to me, oh man, Durst, Trump must be a gift from comedy heaven. Well, yeah, but no, because how do you parody a parody? The 45th president of the United States of America is Donald Trump. That's the joke.
From San Francisco, it's Will Durst at the Chico Women's Club, Friday, August 11th, with local heroes, funny folks, Mary Standish. Doors at 7, show at 8 o'clock. You can get tickets at Chico Paper Company in downtown Chico, online at kzfr.org, and at Blazin' J's in Chico. Will Durst with Mary Standish, coming Friday, August 11th, to the Chico Women's Club. It's a KZFR benefit. Tickets also available at Music Connection in Chico.
Here it is!
From deep inside your radio.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen from Southern California. In mid-July, late July, mid-late July, July. How about our freedom-loving friends in Saudi Arabia? What are they up to? Well, they'd like to be up to more beheading. If we'd get out of their way. You know, they are the great beheaders. Not IS. Our freedom-loving friends. Because you gotta lop off the heads of Donald Trump and Theresa May, the British Prime Minister, for the moment. They're being urged to intervene in the case of a Saudi Arabian student who should be going to U.S. University. He was accepted. Instead, we'll be matriculating and beheading for protesting against the Saudi Arabian government. Mujtaba al-Swaikat was going to start studying at Western Michigan University, but he was arrested in 2012 at a Saudi airport as he was about to fly to the U.S. At the time, he was 17.